Leaving the suit on the hanger, throwing the tie in a corner and taking a holiday from the repetitive grind of politics was a definite bonus at 7:30. Why wouldn't I enjoy interviewing some of the great creative forces across generations? Of the 100 or more such interviews in my time at 7:30, all but a handful yielded insights or reflections with a capacity to enrich in some way, and many were also entertaining. We weren't dealing with celebrity for the sake of it. For the people we interviewed, theirs was earned. With each year that passed, there were more Australians winning Oscars in Hollywood or Tonys on Broadway or Booker Prizes in London or even Pulitzers in New York, and many more potentially on the way. So it wasn't cultural cringe as we chased the big international names along with our own homegrown talent. Performers such as Bruce Springsteen or David Bowie, or writers like John Le Carré, actors and directors like Maggie Smith or Martin Scorsese, weren't queuing up to be interviewed by Mike Willacy or Ray Martin or Andrew Denton or the rest of us because they wanted to bathe in our conversational brilliance. They had concerts or books or films to promote, and often we were a necessary evil. It was up to us to snap them out of autopilot and jag their interest in the first question or two, to take them away from well-beaten paths and set up a fresh discussion they would begin to enjoy, hopefully then bearing some fruit for our viewers. I recently interviewed Pat Rafter for a charity dinner and said to him beforehand, I was well aware of how many times he must have been asked the same questions about his various tennis triumphs and would try to avoid the worst clichés. Thanks, he said. If I'm asked one more time how I felt when I won my first US Open, they might as well take out a gun and shoot me. It's not hard to imagine how he felt. I interviewed Billy Crystal when he brought his one-man show to Australia, a very clever, very funny man, and substantial, with an interesting background. The research brief was loaded with potential and I thought we'd get a good interview. He didn't duck a question, threw out some funny lines, told a good narrative, but I'd read it all before. Everything was recycled. That was my failure, not his. This was probably interview number 200 for him. Maybe he was jet-lagged and I simply failed to find the key that took him out of his routine. I hadn't found the question that piqued his interest and cracked his shell. Viewers were probably entertained, but there were no special insights, no surprising little nuggets. But I wasn't often disappointed with these sorts of interviews. Some guests were extremely generous and candid in the way they shared their lives. The singer-songwriter James Taylor was one, surprisingly, given his handler's attempts to limit the topics. Along with practically every other baby boomer with access to a radio, record player or tape deck, Taylor's album Fire and Rain was a memorable part of an era for me, as it would have been for a big chunk of our audience. As they say, part of the soundtrack of our lives. And he had been married to Carly Simon, and he'd been launched by the Beatles, and he'd had tragedy in his life and nearly lost his own through drugs. He was coming to Australia for a concert tour with Carole King in 2010, and the promoters were offering a double-header interview. I had interviewed King 4 years earlier and so asked for Taylor on his own. They said, all or nothing. I said, nothing. And they said, OK, you can have James, but you'll have to agree not to ask him any questions about drugs. I said I had no idea yet what I would want to ask him, but I would not agree to censorship. I could understand why he might be bored having to rake over the embers of old and sensitive history, but drugs had had a big impact on his life and music, and if I went down the road of a reflective interview, how could I not ask him? I don't know whether it was Taylor himself making that request or one of the many people between him and me, but the interview did go ahead without restriction. The minders were banished to the next room, and it is of the best of its kind that I did through those years. He spoke openly, engagingly, candidly, and I thought what he had to say about drugs was a powerful insight to the overwhelmingly limiting nature of his experience. At the end, he shook my hand warmly and thanked me. One depressive artist who came as absolutely no surprise was Robin Williams. The manic intensity of his genius offered more than a hint of what lay beneath. There was no one else remotely like him. Maybe Jim Carrey tried, but he was no match. Williams' range and breakneck speed as a comedian were matched only by his depth as an actor, and the sense of vulnerability and sensitivity that came through so many of his roles on screen sat with us through the interview. He was more vulnerable than anyone realised, including even him. An insidious form of dementia known as Lewy body dementia was already discreetly at work, and his death by suicide was less than 4 years away. His wife had described the disease as the terrorist inside my husband's brain. As he talks, one moment he's Robin Williams and the next he's in character. He'd spoken by phone that morning to his friend and fellow veteran comedian Mort Sahl, and he was already riffing off a casual comment Sahl had made that America was looking like it's going to go into rehab soon. As he talked, Williams converted Sahl's thought to rehab for old empires, complete with French, Italian, Russian and English accents. Over the course of the interview, there were 8 different accents. "I went into rehab in wine country," he said, "just to keep my options open." When I pointed out that he owned his own vineyard, he shot back, "Yes, that's like Gandhi owning a delicatessen." He even managed to find an excuse for a Teamster accent while talking about working with Australian film director Peter Weir on Dead Poets Society. "One of the greatest experiences," he said. "It was a true learning experience because Peter's more than a director, he's a teacher. I don't know anybody who's worked with him who comes away going, well, that was nice. You come away a different person. He infuses you. He gave us poetry. He gave us music. He played music during takes. It would just get you into this incredible spirit and very inspiring. I remember when the boys stood on the desk, I was going, this is very powerful. And I looked over and I saw a Teamster crying. And I went, okay, this is really working. And then Williams is the Teamster with a Brooklyn accent. You kind of rattled us crazy. I don't know why. The boys on the desk is getting me crazy." Why did he need cocaine when he was already so fast without it, as the heaviest users would be with it? I asked. "I think I did it because it would actually allow me not to talk. It was like reverse medication. You know why they gave Ritalin to hyperactive children? Is that idea of, oh, okay, I don't have to talk to people. It kind of shuts you down, which is self-medication."